Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This episode of the Cult Popture Podcast was brought to you by our Patreon. If you want to tell us which films we should watch or get two extra exclusive podcasts a month, then please consider joining the cult and donating at www.patreon.com/cultpopture. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Film Franchise Fortnights on the Cult Popture Podcast. I am AJ, your host, joined as usual by Richard. Hello, Richard.
What up? How's it going?
Yeah, good, good. And Richard, we're feeling a bit humbled today because usually you and I are the most knowledgeable, qualified speakers on the franchise that we talk about each fortnight. But today we are joined by someone who, without exaggeration, probably is legitimately one of the world's leading experts on the two films we'll be discussing today. It's Tim Batt from The Worst Idea of All Time.
Kia ora koutou katoa. Nice to be here.
Thank you for coming on the show, Tim.
Yeah. A true pleasure to be asked.
So, The Worst Idea of All Time is sort of the show that kicked off the Little Empire podcast network that we're now on. And do you want to briefly explain what Worst Idea is for those who haven't heard of it?
Worst Idea of All Time is myself, Tim Batt, and my friend Guy Montgomery watching and reviewing the same movie week after week for 52 weeks. That is one calendar year, one rotation around the sun. Hanging out with, most recently, the gals. We watched in our most recent season. Well, we call years seasons, which doesn't really make sense, but you get it. You guys are smart. We did Sex and the City 1. Prior to that, we'd done a whole year of reviewing Sex and the City 2. And I'll tell you what, I didn't watch it again in preparation for this episode because I've sworn off them. Made a promise to myself.
We are honoured to have you on here to maybe talk about the two Sex and the City movies one last time.
I'd love to.
That is truly an honour. Yeah. So, the Sex and the City films serve as a pair of sequels to the famous HBO TV series of the same name, which ran from 1998 to 2004 and chronicled the friendship of four women making their way in the hustle and bustle of New York City. Have you guys ever seen the show?
Nah.
Not a lot of it. Caught the odd episode. Yeah. Not much.
No.
Have you seen any of it, Richard?
No, I haven't seen like a single second of it. And it was funny watching the movies and being like, I bet people say this part is classic Sex and the City.
Yeah, well, the TV show was lauded over the years for its progressive takes on once touchy subjects like sexuality, promiscuity, and femininity, while also telling heartwarming stories about love and friendship. And the two films are mostly known for being about the opposite and undoing all that good work. So that's pretty fascinating because I was thinking about it, and the Sex and the City movies are to like 90s independent progressive woman what the Star Wars prequels are for 80s. Obsessive nerdy men, in a way. I read a bunch of think pieces from people who had watched the series and watched the movies, and they were like, you've ruined everything. You've destroyed what I held so dear to me.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even like it was in someone else's hands. It was the same guy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, the first movie we watched, I'm actually the only person here who watched the first one first. out of the three of us. So, the first one was called Sex and the City, or Sex and the City, the movie, came out in 2008, was directed by Michael Patrick King, who did a lot. He didn't create the TV show, but he did direct and write a lot of the episodes, and is one of the creators of Two Broke Girls. Did you guys know that?
It doesn't shock me to hear that, to be honest.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think? And Tim, you probably know. A lot of this is going to be me being like, so what do you guys think? Oh, well, Tim, you probably know. What do you guys think that this movie, the first movie, has on Rotten Tomatoes?
Oh, I don't know this. I'm going to say
31%. Okay. Richard?
I think the first one, from what I understand, I think the first one still has like its fans. But not, I'm going to say like just below fresh, so like just below 60.
It's got 49% on Rotten Tomatoes, which was actually lower than I was expecting. And Tim, I love that despite talking about both of these movies for over 52 podcasts, you guys never really did like a IMDb, Wikipedia deep dive into them, which is potentially the gap in the market we're filling for the those who have come to see us from Worst Idea.
This is good supplementary knowledge for Worst Idea listeners, because that wasn't how we played ball. We just watched the movies, clocked in, and then clocked out and got out of the office, threw our hats in the bin.
One observation I had first up about this movie is that we haven't watched a lot of franchises in this podcast that are like TV, like based on TV shows. I think the only one we've watched is the SpongeBob movies we watched back when we first started the show. And I know that like when these TV like movies based on TV shows do get made, they work pretty hard to be like accessible to those who've never seen the show. And like the start of Sex and the City isn't unclear, but it is probably the laziest I've seen a show based movie be with getting everyone up to speed, because it just like shows some of the choice cuts from the TV show as it's doing its opening credits.
It's bloody brilliant though if you're a straight white dude in your early 30s or late 20s doing a podcast and you're not that familiar with the TV show. It really does catch you up with all the background knowledge you need to dive into the film. Just thoughtful.
I don't know what you want. I feel like what we got is kind of as good as you can, you know, use as a jumping off point for the movie.
No, all right. Well, that's fair enough. I guess it's not, I'm not necessarily criticizing it. It was just a strange thing to see. I'm not used to seeing that in like, you know, my very niche genre of movie that is a TV show based movie.
It is strange to walk into a cinema and be hit with previously on this thing you're watching.
So 2 years later in 2010, we got Sex and the City 2, also directed by Michael Patrick King. And what do you guys think this has on Rotten Tomatoes?
17.
Yeah, I know it's around that.
It's got 15, so very close. Mm-hmm. And
deservedly so.
So, Tim, having seen each of these movies upwards of 50 times each, can you tell us briefly what each of them are about? Like, and what, you know, describe each of them. And I was going to say describe each of them in a sentence, but they're so convoluted that might be hard.
Sex and the City 1 is an attempt at taking four characters who have gone through a really interesting point in their lives of like developing, become self-assured women, sort of found their way, with a couple of them at least, in a way kind of not abject poverty, but through very meager circumstances in the Big Apple and rising up the ranks of their respective professions. And then the movie kind of takes all those interesting interpersonal challenges mixed with all the romance that's, you know, an intrinsic and important part of the show. It just kind of throws all that interesting shit away and goes, guess what? Everyone's fucking killing it. Everyone is so rich, it'll make you want to vomit into your popcorn. And here's some problems that aren't real problems, but we're all rich now. So they say write about what you know. And guess what? HBO gave us like fucking $1 million per ep towards the end there, so our brains are dumb now and we don't understand real human emotion. Sorry, that was a very cynical recap, but
no, all good. The first movie, I would say the thrust of it is that Carrie and Big, who's her on and off again love interest from the TV show, are gonna get married, but he freaks out and leaves her at the altar, and everything's kind of in a very loose term based around that one event. So that's sort of the first one. And the second one, they go to Abu Dhabi, and I can't remember why. Do you remember how much of these movies do you remember having not seen them for?
Mate, I've seen each of them more than 52 times. They go to Abu Dhabi because Smith Jarrett, who is Samantha's love interest, who in the TV show actually nursed her through cancer, would you believe? And then she breaks up with him in the first movie because she gets bored of living in LA with him. So he manages to land a role in this movie, which is set in the Middle East. And then they're at the premiere launch event for the film, at which Samantha's, because Samantha's doing, she did all of Smith Jarrett's PR, so he considers himself sort of indebted professionally to Samantha. Some sort of Faustian bargain has been struck between the two, where they are inextricably linked for time immemorial. So, in spite of the fact that she dumps him in the first movie, he brings her as his date to the premiere event, and there's some tourism officials from the Middle East who have come. Well, it's some sort of like he's a hotel magnate. He owns a bunch of hotels, and he says, I want you to do for my hotels what you have done for Smith Jarrett's career, acting career. So she gets an all-expenses-paid trip to Abu Dhabi with the gals.
Yeah.
Of course.
And they all go on a big trip.
No, that's good. That is, I think we've, for those who haven't seen them, do you know how much of your fan base have actually seen the movies? Because I know told them not to watch them.
Yeah, we were very strict on our, so the first movie we did was Grown Ups 2, and we tell them pretty much every episode to not watch the movie, but we got a bit lazy with that warning later on. So I know some people have dived in, but I can't recommend, you know, joining their ranks if you're listening now.
Yeah. Had you seen these films before, Richard? You said you hadn't seen the TV show.
I haven't seen the TV show, but I think before this, for some reason, inexplicably, I'd seen both films twice. I can't remember the circumstances under any of the four watches. I think maybe I think after I saw two of them, them each once at like a party, and then I saw the first one again. And I think I tried to watch the second one after listening to your podcast about it, Tim, and I was like. Wanted to get context for all the things you were talking about. And then I think I got halfway through it and I was like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd seen the second one when you guys did your commentary, like your director's commentary of the film back in season two of your show. But other than that, I hadn't seen the films before. But I am very curious with this next question I have here, and I know Richard and I are in agreement, but Tim, you've got a fascinating perspective, I'm sure. Which is the better film?
Sex and City 1.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah. I don't know. I thought maybe after watching them each, you know, 52 times, there would be something nuanced that I wouldn't.
That's not a debatable question. That's not.
Okay.
There's nothing objective. Wait, objective, subjective. You know what I'm trying to say. There is a definitive answer for this question, and it goes, Sex and the City 1 is a bad movie. Sex and the City 2 is by far a worse movie.
Agreed. So I could totally understand how the first film would serve as a satisfying conclusion to the TV show. Having never seen the TV show, I would assume that it does an all right job. Like, I think it does some interesting character stuff, and at the very least, it does have a lot of heart, even if it is, like, very aimless in its plotting.
I think you're right.
Yeah. The second movie, though, there's a bad film. Like, my God. If you haven't seen it, which feels a bit redundant to say on this podcast with someone who's seen it 50-something times, it's essentially about a bunch of rich, privileged white women going to the Middle East and reaffirming to themselves and each other how much better the American way of life is. I read one think piece article which referred to the film as ugly on the inside.
Yeah.
Which I think is a very good way of putting it. And for those who haven't listened to the 52-week-long analysis that is season two of The Worst Idea, the main character in this film, for context, is a rich white woman who literally owns two apartments. She nearly cheats on her husband because he buys her a flat-screen TV instead of jewelry. And the climax of the film is the woman having to get to the airport on time lest they be downgraded from first class. Not miss their flight, they just can't. They just won't be in first class.
And no shit, they play that for all the drama in the world. Like, you would think that you are watching a heist movie.
Yeah, no, it's not like Arrested Development or Schitt's Creek, where, like, the extreme privilege of the main characters is used to, like, make fun of them. Like, the Sex and the City 2 audience are supposed to identify with these situations that only rich people would find to be, like, high stakes. You know,
I mean, look, it's a long flight, especially because, and I can't remember the details on this, but the flight path they take, because there's a conversation about them flying over Morocco or something, which is not the flight path on the particular plane ride that they took. So they're in the air for a long time, even longer than most people are when they go from New York to Abu Dhabi.
I'm looking forward to these little pieces of trivia that only someone who could have watched this film as many times as you can offer up. So there's a lot of unconscious privilege of the writing of Michael Patrick King. And I was thinking, like, a more down-to-earth film, for example, if you're looking for something to compare it to, would have had them lose out on First Class and maybe had them be humbled and learn that their riches and lavish lifestyles aren't everything because they're friends and they have each other and they love each other. And it doesn't matter if you're in First Class or not, you know, that's what a normal movie would do with those states, yeah. I guess.
It's pretty crazy that there's zero character development as well. Like, none.
No, that's a good point.
Every time you think there's going to be, it's just like, oh, no, she's just angry about the TV.
Yeah, and they're saved from being, like, harassed by a bunch of men in Abu Dhabi, by a bunch of women in Abu Dhabi who... then, you know, they hide them in a room and reveal that they are also wearing Chanel and, I don't know, fashion labels, but that's one that I think
that's one of them.
And I thought that was so stupid because it kind of feels like they're trying to be like, see, look, the women are independent, because they have a conversation in the movie about how Middle Eastern women are so repressed, and it's like the movie trying to say, but look, they're just like Americans. But that means this movie's set in an alternative universe where that is, like, the American way of life is just the most liberating and free and not, you know, it's not like they act like how the values of Abu Dhabi. It's like everyone is secretly American.
Are you trying to tell me that is not the world in which we exist?
Well, I've never been to Abu Dhabi or America, so I don't know.
You better check yourself before you wreck yourself, brother, because I think you'll find if you go to Abu Dhabi and you get those burkas off those women, you're going to see some Gucci. You're going to see some
Louis Vuitton.
Dolce & Gabbana. Yeah, thanks, Richard. You can see me struggling out there.
As much as I would like to stand up to the challenge of going to Abu Dhabi and getting burkas off those women,
let's get a kickstart going.
A lot of the plans to make films based on the series came out as early as 2004 when the show ended. It had to swap a couple of production companies to actually get started, and Kim Cattrall, who plays Samantha, one of the gals, apparently was very hard to strike a deal with, and which is a common theme across these two movies and a planned third film, which we'll get to later on. So the first film was met with some mixed reviews of critics, one of whom was actually Cynthia Nixon, who plays Miranda in the film, who's also one of the gals.
Who went on to run to be governor of New York and did a lot better than I think most people were expecting.
Oh, cool. Mm. Nice. She disliked the audience response to the to the ending of the film and said, quote, "I remember when we screened the first movie in London, when Mr. Big shows Carrie that the closet he's built for her, and the entire audience clapped. I found that devastating. Maybe that's a strong word, but I was disheartened because I thought, is that what these women in the audience think true love is? A man who has enough money to buy you a walk-in closet?"
It's your fucking movie, Cynthia Nixon. Like, with all due respect, don't make something, show it to people, and then go, "I am disgusted that you enjoyed that. I'm absolutely appalled that you appreciate my work."
Yeah, and, like, to be fair, you know, it's a comment on Big Nose Carrie, and, you know, as shallow as she is, that's what she wanted.
That's a good take, Richard. I like that. True love is knowing how shallow your partner is and playing into that.
So, that being said, a lot of the critical harshness for this film has been speculated to have possibly been a result of sexist male reviewers who had already made up their minds on the film. Raman Setudi from Newsweek wrote, "I can't help wonder, cue the Carrie Bradshaw voice over here, if it's not a case of sexism in the city."
Hey, it's possible. I'm willing to accept I might have some blind spots. But you got to say it's a bad movie, don't you? You know,
totally. I find it really interesting to see this kind of thing discussed in 2008, because like the battle of whether a film that isn't led by straight white males is actually bad, or if it's just bigoted audiences and reviewers saying it's bad, is something that's almost commonplace these days in a post female Ghostbusters world. So I don't know. I thought that was an interesting note. But that being said, I did find, as I said before, a very long article written by a woman who hated the first movie and hadn't actually seen the second movie at the time of her writing it. So I can't imagine how she felt about when she did finally see the second film.
I think, look, I can't escape the fact that it's a bad movie. You know what I mean? Like, you can try and attack it from several different angles and look at it as a fan service. I saw Michael Patrick King talk about it in interviews as saying, what did he say? Oh, no, I think I'm thinking of the second movie, actually. But he, you know, you got to appreciate when these films came out. So the first one came out just as the global financial crisis was happening. So literally the entire world was on the brink of economic collapse. Barack Obama had just come in and had inherited the situation where, like, I don't know, society was a few hours away from ending after Bear Stearns went under, and they were like, oh my God, this thing's not slowing down. And they threw at the audience in the wake of that context, or you know, amongst that context, this woman who can't decide whether or not to keep her small apartment, so just ends up keeping that and getting the big penthouse apartment with her boyfriend. And it's like, what the fuck are we doing here, guys? This is madness. But Michael Patrick King said that he wanted to give the viewers like an escape, sort of a bit of escapism in the films. But he might have been talking about the second one, and that's why they shot it in Abu Dhabi, but actually shot in Morocco because it was too racy to shoot the scenes in Abu Dhabi.
You're encroaching on cult popture territory there, Tim. With
how so? Oh, background fun, knowledge.
Fun pieces of, just by being of behind the scenes trivia.
Big fat nerd about the movie.
When in Rome.
So speaking of the second film, none of these conversations about whether or not it's just sexist male reviewers reviewing the film seem to be present for Sex and the City 2.
People are like, okay, all right, it sucks.
Maybe the men are right with this one.
Andrew O'Hagan of the London Evening Standard wrote that the film could be the most stupid, the most racist, and the most polluting and woman-hating film of the year. And most famous movie critic of all time, Roger Ebert, gave the film 1 star out of 4, and he wrote that the characters were flightweight bubbleheads and the visual style was arthritic, and criticized the voiceover narration as redundant, which tells me he never watched the show, because it's like, Roger, you can't do Sex and the City without the narration.
No, fuck you, AJ, because he's actually got a good point. The narration in the show serves an important purpose, which is inward reflection on a situation you watch unfold in the series. For some reason, in the movies, you see something, they display it on screen, and then Carrie Bradshaw tells you what you've just seen out loud. It's like, we were right there, Carrie. What the fuck are you doing?
So I guess it's more that the script doesn't facilitate the narrative device of narration.
You got it. And not to mention, who's that really great movie reviewer on the BBC who everyone loves?
Mark Kermode.
I don't know if you ran across this in your research, but I think particularly of the second film, you should see Mark Kermode's review of Sex and the City 2. It is spicy.
Yeah, well, speaking of spicing reviews of Sex and the City 2, I've copied one down here from someone named Lindy West, who's a writer, comedian, activist, it says on her Wikipedia page. And this is her review for Sex and the City 2. There is some bad language coming up, so hold on to your hats, because this is one of the most venomous, angry short movie reviews I've ever read. She says, Sex and the City 2 takes everything that I hold dear as a woman and as a human. Working hard, contributing to society, not being an entitled cunt like it's my job, and rapes it to death with a stiletto that costs more than my car. It is 146 minutes long, which means that I entered the theatre in the bloom of youth and emerged with a family of field mice living in my long white moustache. This is an entirely inappropriate length for what is essentially a home video of gay men playing with giant Barbie dolls. Michael Patrick King being gay, I think, is what she's referring to there. Yeah, fuck, man. That's the meanest review I've ever read, I think,
it's
about a
so
film.
Poetic.
Yeah, so we're all in agreement then that they're all very bad.
Yeah, they are all very bad. I mean, you've got to say, though, that the real problem with the movies is Carrie Bradshaw. Everyone else has their interesting quirks and admittedly their foibles, but no one is as uniquely self-obsessed as SJP's lead character, Carrie Bradshaw, which it makes it for a very hard watch because you've got these other characters going through some stuff. Charlotte, for example, is someone who has wanted to start a family for a very, very long time. And seeing her struggle through the trials and tribulations, which I assume are in the series, must have been a, you know, an ongoing battle for the fans. And then that's why I think there is some good fan service that happens in that first movie because she gets kind of rewarded with both actually, in the TV show at the end, she adopts a child with Harry and then gets a biological child as well because they conceive. Yeah. So that's nice.
Yeah, after being told she was reproductively challenged.
Yes, yes. Her words. I'm sure that's not what the doctor said. She would have said, you barren bitch. Dry as Sahara.
Hey, in the Sex and the City universe, you know, Sex and the City's New York, I wouldn't be surprised if a doctor had that kind of witty, sharp dialogue that the critics
absolutely
love, you know.
And then Samantha would have tried to fuck him and it just would have gone full circle.
Yeah, very true. So while we're on the topic of Carrie Bradshaw not being a good person, Richard, you wanted to talk about who's the worst friend.
What?
I asked you about an hour ago. I was like, what do you want to... Is there anything specific you want to talk about? And you're like, who's the worst friend?
Well, okay. Well, we've kind of brought it up that Carrie's clearly the worst friend, right?
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't... There's a few moments you get where she seems to genuinely do nice things. Like, she hires a new assistant in the first film and then she, like, gifts her this bag because it's their anniversary coming up. She pretends she didn't know anything about it and then has given her this new bag. She rents bags to look
it's
fashionable.
A whole thing.
Yeah. It's a whole thing. And I was like, oh, actually, that was kind of a nice moment. But other than that, she's really self-centered and self-absorbed. Samantha gets this big trip to Abu Dhabi and she makes it all about herself because she runs into Aiden. And but yeah, I just think, like, watching it, I was like,
you mean Carrie? Carrie runs into Aiden.
Yeah, yeah.
How dare you mix up the gals?
Don't cross the streams, bro.
But yeah, like, watching the movie, because you often hear, obviously, Carrie's the main character, and then, like, saying, oh, that's such a Samantha thing to say. I feel like it's always Samantha's name that gets put in there. But, like, Charlotte and Miranda are clearly the two best, like, friends. They're clearly the ones you would actually want in your life. There's a scene in the second one where they're, Charlotte's really struggling with motherhood, and Miranda you know, calls her in for a drink and they kind of take sips and while complaining about motherhood. And it's this very, like, honest moment. I thought was the best scene in the second movie. And it's like,
that's a commonly held opinion amongst some of the reviews I was reading, was like, why is there the scene that's ripped straight out of the TV show at its prime in the middle of the, you know, death of the series, essentially.
Yeah. Cause it's a very, like, real moment where they kind of, like, are acknowledging their privilege a little bit as well, because they talk about how hard it is to be a mother, which is, like, obviously a very relatable thing for other mother, like, the fan base of this movie. And then they also talk about, like, and we, you know, we're rich and we have full-time help and we still struggle. Imagine what it's going to be like for other people. And then they have a drink to all those women out there struggling. And I was like, this is, like, the first time I've seen in this movie where they're actually aware of how privileged these characters are and unlikable they are. And Charlotte just seems to be genuinely, like, the nicest person out of all of them.
Charlotte's a good person, eh? Nothing wrong with Charlotte. Yeah. Well, there's a lot wrong with her, but she's a good person. She's got a good heart. But I reckon the same about Samantha and Miranda as well. Like, they're not bad people.
Yeah.
Carrie Bradshaw is a bad person.
Yeah, there's no arguments here.
Did you guys... Tim, I haven't listened. I didn't listen to early on in season four, which is when you covered the first film, and so I'm wondering if you guys discussed this or not. And it's, I'll open, you know, question for you as well, Richard. is Big leaving her at the altar. He immediately regrets it. She's not like publicly embarrassed. She only find, you know, the people find out he's left in front of like her closest friends, and he immediately is like, oh, this is a bad idea. What the fuck am I doing? I have to go get married. Of course I want to get married. And she, Carrie, is just like, no, you humiliated me.
Yeah.
I feel like, not to, you know, not to be the guy watching a movie targeted at women and then be like, the guy's right. But like, I feel like he needed to like actually leave her at the altar for it to actually be as impactful as the movie wants you to think it is.
Yeah.
How do you mean as impactful as the movie wants it? What, them getting married?
So the crux of like Carrie's story arc is that Big left her at the altar.
Yeah.
But he, within 5 minutes, he reverses his decision, and he doesn't literally leave her in front of all their friends and family.
True.
So no one knows it's happened.
Yeah.
So it'd be very easy for him to be like, I'm really sorry, I don't know what I was thinking, and for them to just get on with it, and no one would be any the wiser. But instead, she like doubles down as like, no.
Oh, I don't know about that, AJ. I think that's a pretty unfair. Even to Carrie Bradshaw herself, I think that's a pretty unfair read. Because so what happens, folks? Because I can't stress this enough. Please don't watch this this film. It doesn't deserve your attention, nor any fraction of a cent it may get from your stream on Netflix. but what happens is, Carrie Bradshaw has basically, it's sort of alluded to that she's single-handedly planned the wedding. Big is revealed to basically not have a single friend on God's green earth. They have a rehearsal dinner style event the night before, one night before. And he's just got some work colleagues there who are fucking douchebags who work at the firm that he's at. Heckling Samantha while she's making her like maid of honor speech at the dinner. Crazy stuff. Absolute scenes. So we've got this situation where Carrie Bradshaw has set everything up, booked this whole wedding. It's happening at the New York Library, which is like a very special place for Carrie. All the friends are there. It's the bloody social event of the season. She's been given a dress by Vivian Westwood, the designer, because it's, you know, it's such a big deal that Carrie Bradshaw was getting married. And I mean, they're late by, from memory, at least 20 minutes, and Big's still not there. So then she has to try and track down a cell phone, which actually we should bookmark that, get back to that in a second. So then she rings him and he's like, I can't do this. And this is like the fifth, even having not watched all of the show, I know that this is like the 50 millionth time that Big has let her down. So they then bundle her out of there in a car quick as they can to get her away from all the people, and to expect someone to bounce back from that just because they run into each other on the road in their two limousines. And pick yourself up to the point where she could go through the wedding that day. I think, AJ, you're actually, if I may, being pretty fucking insensitive.
I've been called out.
You have.
Yeah.
By someone who has intimate knowledge of this whole trajectory. But you want to know the fucked up thing? So, folks, listen up, because this is the real tea. The adopted daughter of Charlotte, Lily, grabs Carrie Bradshaw's cell phone and puts it in her little kid clutch, this little cupcake handbag that she's got, and hides it away. And Big is calling Carrie all day just to try and like alleviate his apprehension about getting married. And because he can't make the call, he just gets himself into such a fucking state that he doesn't go through with it and bails. And even though he's like, he gets so close that he is in the limousine outside the library where they are to be wed, and says to his driver, I can't do it, let's go. If Lily didn't hide the cell phone, none of these events would have unfolded. The wedding would be on. Everything would be tickety-boo. This all falls down to a little three-year-old girl hiding Carrie's cell phone. And she never really gets her comeuppance, you know?
Yeah.
That's true. That is true. Man, we need to get someone on the podcast who's watched the same movies 52 times more often.
Well,
because that is one of the most succinct descriptions of a scene, which is one of the challenges we have on the show, is making sure people are able to picture things in their mind's eye. And that was very descriptive. So thank you, Tim.
You're so welcome. There's one other little tidbit that I will share, which I apologize because I'm retreading ground that we tread on our podcast. But I would like to, as two people who have seen the movie now, I would like to put it to you that Louise, who is the assistant that Carrie Bradshaw hires for herself in the first movie, does not exist, a la Fight Club.
Mm.
She doesn't interact with a single character that is not Carrie Bradshaw. She does nothing of consequence that would impact on anyone else's life. All the other people that Louise interacts with are like from out of state in this whole other world. I put it to you two that she is Carrie Bradshaw's imaginary friend.
I had listened to you guys talk about that before I saw the movie, and so as soon as she turned up, I was like, right, here we go. I was like eagle-eyeing, looking for seeing if she interacted with anyone else. And what's also interesting about her character, and I'm not sure if you cover this on the show, but one of the big criticisms that the TV show had was that all the characters are white, and Louise is African-American, and is seen by some commentators on the film to be, you know, an apology from Michael Patrick King by putting a main black character in it who is a subservient.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, I love the fact that she imagines this character to be her only black friend, but it's in like a subservient role to her.
Totally.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an employee. It's literally an employee of hers. And
it's very Carrie.
There is this kind of horrible old trope in movies and TV of an African-American character coming on and serving as a fairy godmother style role, where they can kind of come and support the lead to do something and then fuck right off as soon as they've fulfilled that task.
Yeah.
And I think that describes Louise's role in this to a T, portrayed by multi-award winning Jennifer Hudson. Who also wrote the song that you hear a bunch of times in the movie.
All right. So one thing that I know you've talked about at length and experienced at length, Tim, and Richard now as well, but certainly not to the same token, is that both of these movies are very long.
Yeah.
They each clock in at about 2.5 hours each. And I think this is because Michael Patrick, what's his name?
King.
Michael Patrick.
We call him Mattress Pucklet King, but
that's right. Yep.
That's just a thing.
He clearly does not know how to structure a movie.
Yeah.
Like, the plots of both films are very episodic, and it's actually, like, astonishing how late into both films new plot threads are introduced. And it feels like he wanted to make a couple, like, less like he wanted to make a couple of movies, and more like he was desperate to make more seasons of the TV show. And so the episodes of the TV show were 30 minutes each. The shortest season of the TV series was season 5, which only had 8 episodes, so 4 hours long, which essentially means, Tim, that you guys watched half a season of a TV show once a week for a year twice. Like, that is...
those are some gross numbers you're throwing at me, bro. I don't like that. Yeah.
And so I think to differentiate it from the TV show format, there needed to be more focus in the films themselves. And I think a great way of doing this would have been to make them more like singular events. And I read a Vice article that posited that the narrative question of what would the girls do in a city that wasn't New York is actually pretty intriguing. So maybe the first film should have been Sex in the City goes to Mexico, and the second film should have been Sex in the City goes to Abu Dhabi. You know, that's the plot of the film.
By the way, that is the first time any of the three of us have mentioned that the gals go to Mexico in the first movie.
And but what hit me when watching that scene, it should be the whole movie, but essentially that extended scene where they go to Mexico, is that, so the situation is, it's supposed to be Big and Carrie's honeymoon, but instead of, when he jilts her at the altar, instead of cancelling it, the girls go instead. And that concept, the wife left at the altar takes her best girlfriends on her honeymoon instead of cancelling it, sounds like a perfectly serviceable Netflix rom-com starring like Kristen Wiig, you know, 71% on Rotten Tomatoes, that kind of thing.
Yeah, man. Bridesmaids too. Yeah. If you get the right people in there, it's good fun.
Like, I did think that a lot of the plots that each of the girls kind of have in the first movie feel like seasons of a show. Like, there's the Miranda's been cheated on, and the whole it takes her the whole season to kind of forgive him and get back together, and the whole Carrie getting over Big and then ending up with him again, and then like Samantha has her plot where she's not sure about this guy, and there's the one next door, and then Charlotte's also there without really much to do. But in a lot of ways,
that's not true. She's struggling with her babies.
How dare you, Richard?
But then, in a lot of ways, I kind of like some ideas of the second film a lot more on paper, because it's like, yeah, if you've got to do a movie, do Sex and the City with a huge budget where you send the girls to Abu Dhabi. And like, for some reason, the idea of like something like Samantha going through menopause on paper is so much more interesting to me than like Samantha wants to have heaps of sex again.
No, I agree, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
The menopause plot, menopause plot is like, this feels like what the movie should be about, or at least her character arc, and then it kind of just gets left behind when she finds a guy who's hot enough to crack through the menopause.
Yeah, dickbot.
But yeah, and the same with like Carrie's storyline about married life. It's like, yeah, this is... I mean, if the series had ended up with her just settling down with Big, and then we meet them... you know, 4 to 8 years later or whatever, and married life isn't all it's cracked up to be, kind of thing. That's a good place to take your movie, I think. But then it doesn't execute the ideas as well, obviously.
Yeah. So, before we move on to our segments, Tim, as the resident expert of the two Sex and the City movies,
yes.
Which of the gals are me and Richard? Which one are we? Can you answer that?
Richard is Miranda.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
AJ, I am really, you know, I'm sorry that I have to put this at your feet, but you are Carrie Bradshaw, my friend.
No!
Yeah, no, 100%.
Oh, I'm not romantically successful enough to be Carrie Bradshaw.
You're probably not rich enough either, dude, or a woman in New York, but, you know, if those are the four options...
Yeah.
You're the one leading the ship.
You certainly don't have enough sex to be Samantha.
And you also frequently get left at the altar, so it's kind of a perfect one-to-one.
And you're not a nice enough person to be Charlotte.
Bloody hell. Captain Pylon over here, Richard.
Before you guys started singing Charlotte's praises, I was like, I think I'm Charlotte.
Aww.
And now I was like, well, I can't make that claim now. I feel like I'm Charlotte just because I'm timid and...
You're like, Carrie worried. Because you are the narrative force holding this thing together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're steering the ship. Yeah. Much like the that obscenely narcissistic Carrie Bradshaw.
That does make sense. I just hated Carrie so much that I couldn't see it, you know. I wouldn't allow myself to see it.
That's exactly something that Carrie would say in her narration.
I should have put a little voiceover American accent spin on it.
Yeah, you just needed the two mirrors that are us.
And that's when I realized I was the Carrie Bradshaw I was trying to run away from the whole time.
Oh, God. All right. So, one of our segments on the show, Tim, is called Dumb IMDb Trivia. And one fun thing about IMDb is that the trivia is user submitted. So, this means you can get some fun pieces of trivia, but you can also get stuff that probably isn't true. You can get stuff that's written in a way that's like it was written by a four-year-old, like all sorts of fun stuff. So we like to compile some a very liberal use of the word dumb IMDb trivia and discuss it. So here are some pieces of dumb IMDb trivia from the first film. In the scene when Carrie is returning some books to the library, Sarah Jessica Parker is not wearing any mascara. Also in the scene, she's carrying a hat which she never wears and is actually too small to fit on her head.
What the fuck?
Those aren't pieces of trivia.
Is this true?
So It's on, I don't know, it's on IMDb. You're the one who's seen the movie 52 times.
Does she wear the hat?
It might have sailed right past me, but I don't remember her wearing a hat so small it can't fit on her head. That's really
so
funny.
So small, not only that it can't fit on her head, but that it's worthy of an entry in IMDb's trivia section.
Hell yeah. But then again, it took, like, I had already watched the movie about 25 times, and then my wife walked in on me watching it, which is a horrible, grisly scene. And she was like, what's up with Carrie Bradshaw's dumb bag? And she's got like this hideous bag that's in the shape of the Eiffel Tower.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and I'd never seen it before. So sometimes you get too into the film and it becomes impossible to see Carrie Bradshaw carrying a tiny hat that is too small for your head. No mascara though. That is such a funny, like, it's because someone's just, it's probably not even true, first off. It's just like a subtle application of makeup to try and display something on screen. Someone's like, she's not wearing mascara. I must submit this to IMDb. What are people doing with their fucking lives? Oh, wait a minute. I saw it over 50 times. Never mind.
Yeah. Here's another piece of trivia from the first film. When the ladies are walking to Fashion Week, Carrie says it's spring when it's still winter due to the snow and ice on the ground.
Hard out.
When Carrie says spring, it is because they're going to the spring shows at Fashion Week, which occur in early to mid-February. It's spring to the woman because of the fashion they'll be seeing. However, there is often snow in spring in New York City, as well as other northern states, often well into April.
Now, I could be wrong, because it's been a minute since I saw it, but I'm pretty sure in her narration, she is pretty explicit about saying that it is spring.
Mm.
She says, like, springtime in New York, a time for something, 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 something.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's just because it's well into April and there's still snow on the ground, as is common in New York City.
I never cracked when the seasons are, so, even in New Zealand, where I have lived my entire life. So, I don't know. But Guy and I did try and chart the, like, amount of time that the movie is representing, and it's over a year. It's over a calendar year, which is a crazy thing to do.
Mm. Here's some trivia for the second film. As you mentioned, Tim, the government of Abu Dhabi did not allow filming, calling the film too sexual. Mm. It's called Sex in the City. You know, that could be your first.
The clue was the first five seasons of the TV show.
And here's this piece of trivia isn't dumb, but the following piece of trivia kind of puts it in a new light. So this is on the IMDb trivia section for Sex and the City 2. Two comedians from New Zealand, Tim Batt and Guy Montgomery, are watching this film each week for 52 weeks as of February 2015 and discussing it for their podcast, The Worst Idea of All Time. They previously did this with the Adam Sandler movie Grown Ups 2.
I cannot tell you how delighted I am that my name came before Guy Montgomery's in that tidbit.
But this is the wind is somewhat taken out of these sails when the next piece of trivia listed is Sarah Jessica Parker has admitted to never reading a single review of the film.
that's good practice, though. I think, like, as a comedian, it is a horrible, ghastly business reading your own reviews. So I actually commend her on that. That's good mental health protection.
All right, so one of the things we talk about quite often on this podcast, Tim, is titles. We talk about the titles of the films in the franchise we watch, whether they have, you know, congruity or not, or whether they're just, you know, it feels like they're not trying, that sort of thing. And in regards to Sex in the City, I think it's a, you know, pretty good title for the Chronicles of Carrie and the Gals. But I was reading about the book, which the show is based on, by Candace Bushnell. And she also published a couple of prequels, one of which was called Summer and the City. And this got me thinking about my idea of, you know, make it Sex and the City goes to Mexico and Sex and the City Abu Dhabi be the whole films. Do you think it would have been cool if the films were respectively titled Sex and the Beach and Sex and the Desert?
Yes, AJ. I think that would have been a capital idea. In fact, I'll go one step further and say that that should have been the subtitle. So it should have been called Sex and the City, Sex and the Beach, the movie.
Mm.
And Sex in the City, Sex and Mexico, the movie.
Yes. Nice. Tim, whenever I pitch titles to Richard, he always says, those are really dumb. And that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me.
Yeah. No, you beat me to it, Tim. They're good ideas, AJ.
Oh, thank you.
Now, Richard. I just want to side with Tim.
Okay, so now we're going to move on to one of our final segments of the show, which is continue the franchise. So this is where we both pitch, or we all pitch, I should say, some sequels, some spin-offs, what have you. But before we do that, it is worth noting that the first of Candace Bushnell's prequels, The Carrie Diaries, was adapted into a short-lived TV series, which aired from 2013 to 2014. It starred Anna Sophia Robb as a young Carrie exploring New York City in the mid-80s. So, Tim, you know, season 5 worst idea, watch
now
The Carrie Diaries once a
I
week.
I will have you know that show received some somewhat positive reviews. And it actually looked like it was doing a good thing. It was a shame it got cancelled as early as it did. Did it do like a season and a half from memory?
It did 2 seasons, yeah.
2 seasons, right. And they had backfilled a little bit of Carrie Bradshaw's history. They'd sort of retconned some of her background because there were some loose references to things in the TVs in the HBO series that got contravened, you know, just in favor of a better story for the Carrie Bradshaw. What is it called? Diaries?
The Carrie Diaries.
The Carrie Diaries.
Diaries, yeah.
It was, look, all of that to say, that looked like it was an interesting show. Did I watch it? Absolutely not. Would I? Certainly wouldn't. But it looked like it was, you know, high production values, reasonably well written, got some good reviews. It just wasn't for me. Therefore, it is not allowed on Worst Idea because it looks remotely palatable.
So, and as I'm sure you know, Tim, as well, from the countless Facebook messages your page probably gets sent every day, there is also, of course, chatter about a third Sex and the City film. A script was written in 2016 with the cast signing on. However, later the film was cancelled. Sarah Jessica Parker was quoted as saying, "I'm disappointed. We had this beautiful, funny, heartbreaking, joyful, very relatable script and story. It's not just disappointing that we don't get to tell the story and have that experience, but more so for the audience that has been so vocal about wanting another movie. I'm willing to bet those vocal audience members are fans of your podcast, Tim, who really want another season of you guys covering Sex and the City."
We've made no such... I don't think we made... Oh, maybe we did.
You have absolutely made that promise.
Oh, we did. Oh, okay, got it. Well, okay. This story which which Sarah Jessica Parker was so eager to tell, have you looked into this at all?
I have.
Yeah.
Richard, do you know about this?
It's killing off a character, isn't it?
That's dead right. The inciting incident that propels most of the plot is that Mr. Big dies in a shower, just fucking carks it. And the reason why the movie didn't get made is Kim Cattrall could not be fucked playing a character supporting this egotistical, narcissistic, entitled idiot of Carrie Bradshaw for another, I don't know, 600 hours in celluloid again. So it was all because of Kim Cattrall that it didn't happen. And I say fucking congrats and thank you and well done. Good decision making.
Yeah, Kim Cattrall referred to her to the plans for the third movie falling apart because she went past the finish line portraying the character of Samantha.
It's a nice way of putting
it. But one piece you did miss there, Tim, in your summation was that it's two plot details were released. One is Mr. Big dying, and the other is Samantha receiving sexting and nude pictures from Miranda's son, Brady. Two storylines which couldn't sound more different in terms of stakes, but somewhat appropriate for a trilogy of films that would rather be shorter seasons of a TV show.
Was it intentional or accidental?
I don't know. It didn't say.
Some pretty serious legal implications that I think Miranda would be like intimately across being a lawyer and all.
Sweet. So, my idea for Sex and the City 3 is called Sex and the World. And it would be about Carrie discovering there exists a podcast where two New Zealand comedians read and make fun of her latest book, I Do I, every week for a year. Mortified, she and the gals jet set across the globe to New Zealand to find the podcasters, but they have to make several layovers in many different countries to get there, where they learn in each country how much better America is. By the end of the film, they reach Auckland, New Zealand, and Carrie unexpectedly guest stars on the podcast that's making fun of her, after which she catches the bug and discovers that podcasting really is the modern day application of her craft. She starts a podcast with the gals and it reaches the top charts on Apple Podcasts.
Wow, that's meta as fuck.
It's how I do, man.
Who would you have play the podcasters?
You and me.
Well played, gentlemen. Well bloody played.
Sweet. So who wants to pitch their idea next?
I didn't write mine down. Yours sounded so, like, well written. What's the word I'm looking for? Well written.
Yeah, no, I don't always write it down, but I wanted to impress you, Tim. I succeeded.
I was impressed. It's very well articulated. I'll jump in if you don't mind, Richard, can end on your one. So what I would like for this franchise is a theme park experience. I've forgotten the terminology they use now because it's not like a roller coaster or a thrill ride, but it is an experiential journey into the heart of Sex and the City using a combination of the most advanced roller coaster technology that we've got. There are lasers. There are holograms. We are being visited by Magda, who has died in the world of the Motion Master experience that is Sex and the City 4D. We open. So get this. You tumble into your carriage with your friends and the doors open and you emerge out into the big closet that Mr. Big has built Carrie and you go through it. A la Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Ooh. And then it opens up into this crazy world where you visit all of the friends individually. And so you go to Samantha first and you get this like liquid sprayed on you because some dude's just done his dirty deed on you. And you feel it and you smell it and it's horrible. And then you
are. It's the dude with the funky spunk.
Exactly. You go over to Charlotte and you emerge in her like pantry and then you peep out and she's just screaming her tits off at her kids. And it's very loud and it's chaotic and then her nanny comes and takes them away and then the nanny leaves with Charlotte as well. So you continue on your journey and then you see Miranda and she and Steve are just fucking going at it and you get to watch in 3D. And to be honest, it's pretty grisly stuff. And then that's the end of the ride.
Wow. Wow. Have we ever had a theme park experience pitched as a continue the franchise? That's great. I love it. I love the idea of like what theme park would make a movies that just don't deserve to have theme park rides made up.
Sometimes the theme park ride comes first. I think that's what happened with Pirates of the Caribbean. Yeah.
And the Haunted Mansion.
And the Jungle Cruise.
Yeah, Jungle Cruise, the upcoming Dwayne The Rock Johnson movie.
Classic.
Yeah.
I went on a in Japan. I was in Japan recently. I got back one Sex in the City plus one podcast ago because that's what I've been doing since I arrived. There was a Jaws ride, which was like you're on a boat cruise where you are being taken around the place where Jaws was filmed, and then a shark attacks the boat, and then the like skipper, who is just like some actor, attacks, like, you know, shoots the shark or whatever. And then at the end, he's when you come back to the like entrance, he's like, "Hey, can you guys not tell my boss about the shark?" And the guy we had was like so funny. The whole thing was in Japanese. I didn't understand a word of it, but the guy was really giving it his all, and it was such a fantastic experience.
Was this Universal in Osaka?
Yeah.
I've been on that ride. It's fucking great. Did you do the RoboCop one? Because that is so confusing as a non-Japanese speaker.
No, I don't think they had. What was the RoboCop one?
You get the vast majority of it is someone who works at Cyberdyne giving a speech to you entirely in Japanese. No subtitles, no headphones with the translation, nothing. And I just love the attitude that they have there of like, well, if you're not going to learn the language, get bent.
Yeah, no, there was the one where you have to help Spider-Man. That was quite good.
That was great. Yeah, they blow
hot. He spoke Japanese. Yeah. No, that was bloody fantastic time.
Anyway, Fever Richard, and, stop stalling. Yeah. What's your...
Okay, so I'm just trying to think of a new one because I had a theme park ride. No, I didn't. my idea is ideally I'd want this to come out in like 10 years' time kind of thing. So this is like, you know, a distant sequel of sorts. So it follows a young girl who... moves to the big city. She's from small town America. She wants to make it big in the fashion industry. So she's bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, moves and manages to get a job making coffees or something at Vogue magazine. And then, you know, things don't really go her way. So late at night in her shitty one-bedroom apartment, she's there wondering why she never made it. In the same way that her favorite author did, and she pulls out one of the books, and it's written by Carrie Bradshaw, and she's lived her, this girl's lived her whole life idolizing this lifestyle of, you know, sex in the city, and, you know, just like being rich and shallow. And so she decides, oh, I'm going to reach out to Carrie Bradshaw and find out what happened because no one's heard from her in several years. And eventually she does manage to find kind of a washed up Carrie Bradshaw who's lost everything. What happened was Mr. Big, as I know you mentioned, you guys kind of theorized on your podcast, Tim, about what it actually is that he does for a living.
Yeah.
But it turns out he was kind of just the fall guy for some kind of Ponzi scheme.
Oh, shit.
And after being Me Too'd, it was found out that he'd done some kind of dicey stuff. Keep it relevant. You know, and then people started looking into his life and his company, and they found out that it's actually just all this big cover for like money laundering or something or whatever. He loses all of his money, ends up killing himself because, you know, you will keep in the Mr. Big death thing that they wanted so desperately to put in the third film. And so Carrie Bradshaw's washed up. She's lost everything. Samantha absolutely does not talk to her anymore kind of thing. They've completely fallen apart. She sees Miranda every now and then. They text, you know, once a year. And Charlotte, being the good friend she is still there and supportive and everything like that. And it's kind of this tale about how this woman that once had it all and now has nothing. And she, I guess eventually the lesson that this young girl we've been following would learn is that, you know, money and having all the clothes you want aren't actually what it's all about. It's about your friends. So, and it would be cool. It would be called like Bradshaw or something.
Oh, cool. I like that title for some reason a lot. It's a good scheme for it.
It's got the Logan or Joker.
Yeah, kind of
I was going. Yeah, title. Creed was the one I was going for.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I wish you guys said it sounded like Creed. Well, hey, that is the end of our show. Thank you so much, Tim, for coming on. It's been an honor.
Oh, thank you, guys. Thank you for everything you do.
We owe you a bit more than what it may sound like, because Richard and I actually reconnected. We went to broadcasting school together, but we didn't see each other for a few years, and we actually reconnected after meeting up with each other at one of your, was it a Worst Idea live show?
Oh, fuck, yeah, I'd love to hear that.
It was it was a night where you and Guy both did shows, and then you did a live show, and I remember, we're sitting there for all three of them. And if you listen closely to, I remember the episode as well. It's the We Are Your Friends, I think episode 3. It's a live show. And AJ, you can hear our distinctive laughs at certain points.
Hey, was that at the Monte Cristo?
Yeah, it was.
You want to know a fun fact about that episode? Which I can't remember. We might have shared this on the podcast, actually. There was a couple who came, I'm pretty sure that it was to the podcast live show to that, and he disappeared. and we saw them. It was two people, a guy and a girl who we know off quite noisily, like they were both kind of hammered. And it turned out they totally fucked during our podcast record in the toilets there at the Monte Cristo.
Wow.
So while,
oh my gosh.
While you can hear AJ's beautiful laugh wafting through onto the microphone, if you listen hard enough, you turn that volume up and you've got just the right headphones, you might hear some copulation at a downtown comedy venue that no longer exists.
Wow. That's Sex in the City right there.
It sure is.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Tim. Tell us what, before we get into what franchise we will be covering next fortnight, which was decided and voted on by our patrons over at patreon.com/coldpopture. Tim, can you tell us, for those who are in what I'm sure is the small percentage of people listening to this who haven't heard of Worst Idea of All Time, give us another plug for it. Where can we find it? When is it coming back? I'm sure a lot of people are wanting to know.
It's sort of, you know, it exists in a way at the moment via a different podcast called Overlooked and Undercooked. Just go to littleempirepodcasts.com and have a click around on there. You might see some shows you like.
Nice. Cool. And as usual, you guys can find us. Cold Pops are everywhere. We're also on Little Empire Podcast, and you can find us on YouTube and Facebook and Instagram, or you can email us at coldpopsmedia@gmail.com. And next fortnight, Richard, what franchise are we doing?
I believe it's Mad Max.
Yep, we're doing the four Mad Max films, which one of the best things about this show, Tim, is that we get to slingshot violently back and forth between types of movies such as Sex in the City and Mad Max.
Fantastic. So that is
very, very fun. We did Jaws, I think, was a couple episodes back.
Hold on, there's four Mad Max movies?
Yeah, dude, there's Mad Max, Mad Max The Road Warrior, Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome, and Mad Max Fury Road.
I forgot about Road Warrior for some reason.
That's one of the, that's I think the best ones.
Oh, true. All right, as you were.
All good. So anyway, thanks so much, Tim. And we'll see everybody next episode. Bye.
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 I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.